Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with historian Blaine Roberts, co-author with her husband, Ethan Keitel, of Denmark Vesey's Garden, Slavery and Memory in the Cradle of the Confederacy. Who owns history? It is a question that's often asked these days as we consider the future of war memorials and guided tours to historic places. We'll be talking about that today with Blaine Roberts, who with her husband, Ethan Keitel, is the co-author of Denmark Vesey's Garden, Slavery and Memory in the Cradle of the Confederacy, set in Charleston, South Carolina. Blaine and Ethan both teach history at California State University in Fresno, and Blaine is a Louisiana native. Blaine Roberts, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, I'm curious, how much did growing up in Louisiana lead you to think about these issues? How aware were you growing up?
I think that being from Louisiana, being from the South, certainly played a role in my interest in these questions of what we remember and what we don't remember. Although my awareness probably did not really come to kind of full fruition until I went away to college in New Jersey, where I took a class in Southern history and for the first time learned, for example, that the Civil War was in fact caused by slavery. In high school, I was taught back in 1991 that the Civil War was caused by states' rights. And that, of course, is a holdover from a propaganda campaign that was started by white Southerners in the late 19th and early 20th century, really trying to deflect away from the real cause of the Civil War. So certainly my upbringing in the South played a role, but it took kind of traveling around and being in different parts of the country to really see how what I had been taught was not always true.
And you and your husband lived in Charleston for many years, and you have deep feelings for that particular place.
We do. Charleston is really an amazing city. It's beautiful, much like New Orleans is, and it is so steeped in history. But one of the things that we found when we were there is that the city has really struggled to be honest about its past, specifically about its slave past. About 50% of the enslaved Africans that came to what eventually became the United States first stepped foot onto our shores in Charleston or the surrounding Sea Islands. Charleston had an enslaved and black majority before the Civil War. Charleston was in many ways the kind of ideological epicenter of the defense of slavery, and that culminated in the first vote for secession from the United States when South Carolina voted to secede in December 1860. And then, of course, the first shots of the Civil War, a war fought to defend slavery, those happened in Charleston. So Charleston has a very complicated slave past, but what we found when we lived there is that white Charlestonians in particular had a very hard time confronting that and acknowledging that fact.
And it endures to this very day. I wonder if you'd tell us that story about renting an apartment.
Sure. So my husband and I were moving to Charleston, South Carolina in the summer of 2005 from Chapel Hill, where we were living at the time. And so we drove down one June morning. We had a list of apartments to look at. Turned out that the first apartment on our list was the basement floor of a very beautiful antebellum home. So we rang the doorbell, and the homeowner welcomed us inside the basement apartment. And as we were wandering through, looking at the space and, you know, wondering how our furniture would fit, we were making small talk about the history of the house. And at one point, one of us said, well, how would this basement here have been used when the home was originally built before the Civil War. And the homeowner said, well, this would have been the workspace of the servant. And then one of us replied, you mean of the slaves? And then she countered, no, of the servants. There's no evidence in the historical record that they weren't paid. So that was her explanation for who had been working in that space before the Civil War. It was a very interesting way of erasing the presence of enslaved laborers in that particular home. And as we later confirmed through historical research, the laborers who were there were, in fact, enslaved. So it was an interesting introduction for us to the fact that many white Charlestonians, even today, have a very hard time grappling with the city's enslaved past.
Oh, absolutely. And to come up with a double negative.
Yeah.
It's no evidence that they weren't paid.
It's a really, really, I think, meaningful double negative.
Absolutely. Well, and let's talk a little bit about Denmark Vesey. Would you talk a bit about this revolutionary figure? He's in the title of your book, and the idea of Denmark Vesey's garden is so interesting.
Sure. Denmark Vesey was born a slave. But, amazingly, he was able to buy his freedom in Charleston because he won a lottery, a city lottery, which is kind of an amazing story. But he was unable to free his other family members. So as you can imagine, he was incredibly frustrated by this, and just in general frustrated by having to live under the white supremacist slave regime in Charleston. So he and several dozen co-conspirators planned a large-scale slave insurrection that was to have taken place on July the 14th, 1822. July the 14th, of course, is Bastille Day. However, the slave insurrection was thwarted before it could be carried out, and ultimately Denmark Vesey and over 30 co-conspirators were very hastily tried and executed. So Denmark Vesey is a very famous and, to some Charlestonians, infamous figure in the city of the history. And one of the reasons that he appears in our title is because he's really the ultimate embodiment of what we call the unvarnished memory of slavery. And this is a very important theme in our book and in the history of Charleston in general. The unvarnished memory of slavery is a memory of slavery that comes down to us through the years from the formerly enslaved and their descendants. And the unvarnished memory of slavery holds that slavery was central to the history of Charleston, South Carolina, and the nation, that slavery did in fact cause the Civil War, and that slavery was a brutal, inhumane institution that was rooted in violence. And Denmark Vesey proves that, embodies that, because here was a man who had been born a slave, who did manage to secure his freedom, and yet he was willing to plot this large-scale insurrection to achieve the freedom of other slaves, because slavery was so awful. The garden part of our title refers to the whitewashed memory of slavery, and that's the other memory of slavery that we really trace in the book. The whitewashed memory of slavery was forged by slave owners and their descendants. And the whitewashed memory of slavery says slavery wasn't really all that bad. It was beneficial to slaves. It was civilizing as an institution. And the whitewashed memory says slavery wasn't, in fact, all that important to the history of Charleston, and it did not cause the Civil War. So the book's title, Denmark Vesey's Garden, is really intended to capture these two dueling memories that emerged first in 1865 when the Civil War is over, and that really come down to us today.
Well, there are so many complicated strands in this story, in talking about how we interpret history and how the ways we do that change over time. And I have to say, one of the most complicated and bizarre stories is a chapter called The Sounds of Slavery.
Yeah.
And I wish you'd talk a little bit about that, because I found it so fascinating and just conjured up the most bizarre mental images, actually.
Well, that's right. So The Sounds of Slavery is a part of the book that analyzes several singing groups that were popular in Charleston, particularly in the 1920s and 30s. And what was so fascinating about uncovering this story is who the singers were and what they were singing. So the best example is a group called the Society for the Preservation of Spirituals. The Spirituals, in their name, is a reference to slave spirituals. So this was a group that was founded in 1922 to sing slave spirituals to preserve them for posterity. Now, the really complicated part of this story is that the singers, the members of this group, were not African American, they were white. These members were all descended from former slave-owning families. They had grown up on plantations in the Charleston area after the Civil War, and they had heard African Americans on those plantations, free African Americans, sing slave spirituals. And so these white men and women start this group to preserve them. What is really complicated about this is that during their performances in Charleston, they dressed up in antebellum costumes, the antebellum garb of slave owners. So the women, for example, wore hoop skirts. They also, as they performed these slave spirituals, argued in front of their audiences that slave spirituals were not songs that were about the torment of slavery. So in other words, they completely stripped slave spirituals of their meaning. We know from slaves that slave spirituals were expressions of wanting freedom, of being desperately unhappy under the institution of slavery, but these members of this group said that that was not the case. And so the Society for the Preservation of Spirituals is a really good example of how whitewashed memories of slavery thrived in Charleston. But not just in Charleston. The Society for the Preservation of Spirituals was so popular that they performed up and down the East Coast in the interwar period, and they even performed for Roosevelt in the White House.
Fascinating. Oh, fascinating.
Yes.
Now, one of the key players in the long debate about race in Charleston is a museum that was devoted to slavery, the Old Slave Mart Museum. And you talk a lot about its direction over the years.
Yes. So the Old Slave Mart Museum is a museum that is located in a former slave trading complex. In other words, an auction house where slaves were brought into Charleston to be sold to the highest bidder. And what's interesting about this museum, it is open today, is that it was first opened back in the late 1930s. And the woman who opened it is a kind of fascinating figure. She was not native to Charleston. She was, as they would say, from off. She grew up in Ohio. She was a white woman who ended up working in Columbia, South Carolina, vacationed in Charleston, and then said, I like it so much here that I'm going to move here. So she noticed that a lot of people, a lot of tourists in particular, walked by this old slave mart and seemed to be taken with it. So she decided to buy it. And she also decided that she needed to figure out the history of the complex. A lot of locals claimed that it was not a site where slaves were bought and sold. But she thought that it was or had been such a place. And so she was able to confirm that through historical research. And so she opened this museum and said very plainly, yes, this was a slave trading complex. But what's interesting about the course of her museum, she ran it for about 20 years, is that over time, she became what we might call a convert to the local line on slavery. She had very early on been proud of her family's own anti-slavery heritage. She had Union veterans on her side of the family. She remembered talk in her family about its abolitionist leanings. But here she is in Charleston. She's opened up this museum. She did prove that it was a slave trading complex, but she starts to toe the local line on how slavery was not all that bad, on how it was a benevolent institution, on how it was good for slaves. And so What we end up arguing is that this was really a lost opportunity for the city. A woman proved that there was a slave trading complex still standing in 1930s Charleston, and yet she takes this opportunity and really kind of squanders it and does not tell an unvarnished history of slavery and slave trading in the city.
It's amazing, amazing story. And then you talk a lot about the different tour guides, and people might be tempted to dismiss tour guides, but they are important representatives of a city's history. And, you know, people come to a town, they take a tour, and then they go back home and tell stories they've heard. So this is something that has evolved in many interesting directions in Charleston.
That's right. Your point is very important. Tour guides are how visitors learn their history when they travel somewhere. That's true in Charleston. It's true in a place like New Orleans. Now, Charleston, to its credit, really pioneered a tour guide licensing program, several decades ago. And so if you want to become a tour guide in Charleston, you have to study an official tour guide manual that is produced by the city. You have to take a test, and you have to do demonstration tours, and that's how you get a license. However, it's not easy to necessarily control what tour guides say once they are out on the streets, so to speak. And so a good example of how tour guides, even in the last decade or so, continue to whitewash history would be a tour that Ethan and I went on about 10 years ago. It was a tour, a carriage tour through downtown Charleston, and the tour guide was talking about the early demographics of the city. And she said that in the 18th century, about 85% of the population of the city had been English, and the other 15% had been French Huguenot. This was a pretty breathtaking claim, because in fact, Charleston had an enslaved majority.
Right.
So in that moment, she completely erased the early history of slavery in the city. So we believe and argue that it's very important for tour guides in a city like Charleston to have access to good information and then also use that information once they're out in the field. But that's the tricky part.
Amazing, just amazing. Now, of course, Charleston has had its own struggles with Confederate monuments and how to memorialize people in history. And this is a story with great implications for the rest of the country. And you take pains to extend that even to New Orleans, where we've certainly had our own controversies.
That's exactly right. And after the Emanuel shootings in June 2015, this really became a national conversation. Of course, many of the specific conversations were centered in the South because that's where so many Confederate monuments are, but it did become national. So you see communities like New Orleans finally confronting the fact that Confederate monuments are not, in fact, good history. They tell historical lies because they obscure what the Civil War was about. So it's the events in Charleston that really sparked this national conversation. But in a place like New Orleans, you do see some very concrete actions taking place. So a group like Take 'em Down NOLA was very effective in pushing the city to really reconsider whether or not it was appropriate in the 21st century for those monuments to still stand. And Mayor Mitch Landrieu, of course, was responsive to these arguments and oversaw the removal of the monument in New Orleans. I think that what's kind of fascinating about this is that not much has happened in Charleston, which was the location of this horrible massacre. In Charleston, the situation is complicated by the fact that there is a state law that says you cannot remove any kind of monument or memorial like this without legislative approval. So even if locals on the ground want to do something, their hands are tied in a way that was not true for the citizens of New Orleans.
So fascinating. And this debate just rages on and on. Ugh. We've been talking with Blaine Roberts, who is the co-author with her husband Ethan Keitel of Denmark Vesey's Garden, Slavery and Memory in the Cradle of the Confederacy. You can meet Blaine and Ethan Tuesday, July 24th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop when they discuss their work with Tulane professor Randy Sparks. Blaine, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear for the whole round.
For those of you who enjoy the Tricentennial Reading List on Tuesday at 8:44 during Morning Edition and 5:44 during All Things Considered, here's a longer listen to my conversation with Jason Berry about music books. Now, when I showed you this list originally, you added a lot of wonderful books about jazz, which I am so grateful for. And the first was Jazzmen by Frederick Ramsey with some chapters by Bill Russell.
Jazzmen is really the first, it's kind of the urtext, you might say, about the idiom. Fred Ramsey and Bill Russell made a trip to New Iberia. I guess it was in 35 or 36. And they found Bunk Johnson, who had not been playing for many years. You know, when you think about these guys journeying from New York and Pittsburgh and other places because they heard the story that this old man, the living link to Armstrong, was. So anyway, they sort of rehabilitated him, and Russell eventually began recording him in the 1940s. But Jazzmen is an anthology, and it was the first book to really explain how the music arose. And Russell's chapters on New Orleans do stand the test of time. Mm-hmm. He has a very insightful section on Congo Square, and he talks about the importance of melody and how dancing was so central to the music of early jazz.
This is a dancing town.
It's a dancing town.
So New Orleans Jazz, a family album by Al Rose and Edmund Souchon.
Well, it's an anthology. No, it's not an anthology. It's more like a dictionary with photographs.
Right.
Capsules, short profiles of various musicians. Interestingly, near as many white, Sicilian and Irish musicians in the book as African Americans. Wonderful photographs of early brass bands. It's a great reference text. You know, those guys worked years on that book, painstakingly gathering information on all these musicians. So to me, it's a book that has to be given its due.
And then The History of Jazz by Ted Gioia.
Ted Gioia's The History of Jazz. What's so interesting about that book and a book that came out just within a few years, Louis Armstrong's New Orleans by Thomas Brothers, who teaches at Duke, those two books really put an emphasis on church music and the importance of the Jubilee dancing in these rural churches as rural black folk made their way to the city from roughly the 1880s to about 1910. There were 40,000 African Americans who came in from the plantation belt during that period. And at the same time, there was a flood of Sicilians coming in as well. What's instructive about both of these books, The History of Jazz by Ted Gioia and Louis Armstrong's New Orleans by Tom Brothers, is the way in which each of these scholars delves into what those churches were like, the way the spirituals were ebbing and a more upbeat kind of religious singing was emerging. jazz is a fusion of the sacred and the profane. You had many of the same musicians who are playing the sawdust-spattered floors of Storyville cabarets at night, and by day they're sitting in churches and playing dirges as the, you know, coffins are coming out. So I think the religious dimension of the music got appropriate focus and weight from those two books.
And Thomas Brothers' book is so much fun to read. You feel like you're hearing the music, seeing the city as it was then. It's a very visual, rich book. We've been talking with Jason Berry about the very best in New Orleans music books. Jason, thank you so much.
Susan, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
The Tricentennial Reading List is brought to you by the Hellas Foundation, the John Burton Harder Trust, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Kim Vaz DeVille celebrates the release of Walking Ratty, The Baby Dolls of New Orleans, Sunday, July 22nd at 2 at the Xavier University Administration Building. Blaine Roberts and Ethan Keitel discuss and sign Denmark Vesey's Garden, Slavery and Memory in the Cradle of the Confederacy, Tuesday, July 24th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Tulane professor Randy Sparks moderates the discussion. Poet Melinda Palacio reads from and signs Bird Forgiveness, Wednesday, July 25th at 6 at Octavia Books. Catherine Clark discusses and signs My Exaggerated Life, Pat Conroy, Friday, July 27th at 6 at Octavia Books. Jason Heller discusses and signs Strange Stars, David Bowie, Pop Music, and the Decade Sci-Fi Exploded, Saturday, July 28th at 6 at Octavia Books. This month, loyal readers are celebrating 20 years of Harry Potter. Tubby and Coos will sponsor a Harry Potter birthday party for adults, Saturday, July 28th from 6 to 8, with a potions bar above Fritzl's Jazz Club. That's at 733 Bourbon Street. Tickets are limited. You can get them at tubbyandcoos.com. Tubby and Coos will sponsor a Harry Potter birthday party for kids Sunday, July 29th from noon to 2 at Tubby and Coos Mid-City Bookshop, 631 North Carrollton. Tickets available at tubbyandcoos.com. And coming up August 4th at the East Bank Regional Library, the Tricentennial Literary Festival. You'll get to hear Patricia Brady talk about Outsiders. Emily Toth will dish on Kate Chopin's Secrets. Cynthia Lejeune Nobles will talk about Ignatius J. Riley, A Very Lucky Dog, and I'll be there too. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.